On the Empire podcast this week, Anomalisa, directors Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson move really slowly into the pod booth because it's a stop motion thing, while we also chat to the witch star Anya Taylor-Joy. All that and more on the movie podcast that just can't get the Ant-Man theme tune out of its head. It's a terrifying earworm, or ear ant, if you will. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire podcast. This week, I'm joined by three colleagues, three of such lethal cunning. Count them. First up is our junior online writer, Emma Thrower. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Chris.
Do you know why I've moved you first?
I do have an inkling.
What is an inkling?
Something to do with my appearance, maybe.
That sounds fairly sinister, but yes, it's your hair. You've dyed your hair pink.
I have.
Now, it looks fantastic.
Thank you.
Well done. But why did you dye your hair pink?
I didn't go in expecting to do it.
Mm-hmm.
My hairdresser and I just went a bit crazy and this is what happened.
So you went a little bit off the top, Bob, and Bob went, all right, I'm going to shave you. It's got to be pink.
Yeah, that's exactly what Bob said.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Or is it Tony or a guy?
Neither.
Okay, interesting. The reason I put you first is because I want to ask our other two colleagues with such lethal cunning. First up is our banana-loving features editor, Dan Jolin. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Chris.
Have you ever done anything with your hair?
Yes.
What have you done?
Well, I permed it. Once.
Okay.
Please have pictures.
Yeah,
please. I do have pictures, but I ain't showing them to any of you. Any of you, I mean anyone listening.
Why'd you perm your hair?
Why?
Yeah.
Because I was young and I was foolish and I wanted to have hair like Roland out of Tears for Fears.
Did you look like Eric LaSalle in Coming to America?
No, I didn't, James.
Soul Glow.
No. No? Okay. Interesting. No.
But yeah. Totally permed it.
Totally permed.
Totally permed.
That's amazing.
It was like a mother-loving perm.
That is amazing. And now your hair is long. When I first met you, your hair was very, very short.
Mm.
You know, all those years ago.
Hairy pea head.
Back when you worked for our terrifying foes.
Mm-hmm.
That long.
Yeah.
But now it's long. It's lush. Dan's hair is lush.
Yep.
It's longer than mine.
It is longer than yours.
For the people that can see this on the podcast.
Yeah, it's really good, I think, discussing hair on a podcast.
Definitely.
If you can't see, but there you go. And last but not least is James Dyer, a man who couldn't do anything with his hair if he tried. Listen to me talk, I'm tempting fate. But yeah, you're bald.
Thanks,
bald
Chris.
As a Statham impersonator. In fact, you are Britain's 47th greatest Jason Statham impersonator. Is that correct?
Yes, I am famously shit Jason Statham.
Have you ever done anything with your hair? I've seen pictures of you when you actually had hair.
Long hair.
It's so weird.
I had longer hair than Dan when I was a teenager.
Yeah, like proper long, like
proper
Eddie
long.
Vedder long.
Metal hair.
Yeah, metal, yeah. When did it start to go?
When I was 18, it started to slightly thin. And so I did the thing that all balding men do. I went into massive denial and shaved my head. and have done ever since.
There we go.
Yeah.
I dyed my hair blue once.
Did you?
Mm.
Really?
Yeah.
Hang on. Didn't you dye your hair blue when you came to interview for the Empire job?
Yeah, when I came to interview. No, I didn't dye it because I was interviewing for the Empire job.
This was an interesting tactic.
It was already dyed. Yeah, yeah, I went, hey, they'll think I'm edgy and cool. No, my girlfriend at the time, she had red bits in her hair. And so she went, hey, you should have blue bits in your hair.
Didn't
so
Ryan Phillippe do something similar for, was it Playing by Heart? What was that ensemble piece he did that Angelina Jolie was in? And he turned up on the first day shooting with blue hair, inexplicably.
Really?
That was a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
It didn't last. My blue period didn't last. But there you go. Well, nothing to do with news or movie.
Sorry.
But yeah, I just thought it would be worth pointing out.
Mm. You look like Lightning from Final Fantasy 13. Just throwing that out there.
I was going to compliment Emma. I think it looks really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Cool.
Should I say cool? Is that?
That's good for me.
Say cool?
That's maybe the first.
Or should I say rad? Wicked.
What any compliment?
Okay.
What do the kids say these days? Are you trying to? You know, it looks like you're auditioning for the X-Men. Are you auditioning for the X-Men?
Yeah, you got me.
I thought I had. Okay. Okay, let's move on from discussions of hair to tackle this week's question with our usual blend of professionalism and deep research. So this comes from @SlickPelican via Twitter, who says, I see the highly touted Event Horizon, never heard of it, mate, it's a lowly 24% in Rotten Tomatoes. What the fuck? What other terribly reviewed films do you love? Well, first of all, can I just say that Event Horizon is now being critically reappraised, mostly by me.
By me.
It's a 97, now 98% on Chris's Rotten Tomatoes, there's an image.
Reviewing it under CBS.
I do. Dr. William Weir gives it 5 stars. Captain Miller gives it 6.
Chris's Rancid Fruits.
Let's move on swiftly. So, you know, everyone loves a terrible film, don't they? Not that Event Horizon is terrible, but at the time it was not well reviewed. Mm. But I think, actually genuinely, I'm not kidding, it genuinely has been critically reappraised. It is certainly seen as Paul Thomas Anderson's best film. That's because he didn't direct it. Paul W.S. Anderson's best film. Actually, you know what? Screw it. It is Paul Thomas Anderson's best film as well. Right, Jimbo, You like Drek.
I mean, really? Yeah.
You do.
I suppose some of the films that I love that I would have thought were badly reviewed are in fact not. Like, I love Commando because it's brilliant, except it's not really brilliant, is it? And yet it is fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
I've just checked.
So is The Running Man, which I also love and assumed was much maligned. I think standards were lower in the 80s, but I'm quite pleased. One of my all-time guilty pleasures, Nuns on the Run, however, is not fresh.
Nuns on the Run taught me the phrase, spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch.
Yes.
Yeah, which you know, being from Northern Ireland, but not of the Catholic persuasion, it was a phrase that was just lost to me. But there you go, spectacles, testicles, wallet, yeah, and watch. It's the only reason why I remember Nuns on the Run, and there's nothing to do with the shower scene. But there we go.
Yes.
Don't say it in that creepy way.
That's not the reason I love the film.
Okay.
So I'm a big fan of Robert Coltrane's work. No, that also, weirdly, Waterworld and The Postman are both films I quite like. I'm sorry to say that's 6 hours of your life you never get back, but still, I don't think either of those are particularly well regarded.
Waterworld and The Postman. Yeah. Again, Waterworld's had a bit of a reappraisal over the years.
Has it? Mainly by Kevin Costner.
Yeah, because this film's awesome, guys. You should definitely check it out on Kev's Rancid Fruits. Quite like that idea. Interesting. Dan?
Well, it's a funny one, this, because there is a film which I recognise as being terrible, but I enjoy watching over and over again, and that's like 10% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's Dungeons & Dragons.
Ooh.
But I know it's crap.
It really is.
So I'm not sure it counts. I'm not sure it really counts. But
with the Jeremy Irons?
With Jeremy Irons as the evil wizard Prophion, and it's got a great line where his henchman, Bruce Payne, actually says the line, "Just like you thieves, always taking things that don't belong to you."
Well, yeah. Quite literal, isn't he?
They're thieves, dude. Of course, that's what they do. You're just stating the obvious. Anyway, it just makes me laugh. But there's also, I think, 47%, a bit higher on Rotten Tomatoes, is The Mummy Returns. Which, I really like. The first film, The Mummy, is just fresh. It's just over the limit on Rotten Tomatoes. And I really enjoyed that. I was like, I wasn't expecting anything from it. So this is the Stephen Sommers film starring Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser. And I thought those two had, like, proper chemistry. And I thought it was really fun. And added sort of a bit of a fun kind of, you know, cheap Indiana Jones vibe to it.
Definitely better. The second one's better than the third one, which is pretty awful. Yeah. No. But none of them are as good as The Ride at Universal Studios. So... Yeah. Just around that.
Okay. But The Mummy Returns has zombie pygmies.
It does. It does.
It does have zombie pygmies.
It has zombie pygmies.
And Beatles. The terrible CG, The Rock.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. There is that. But also, you see, the other thing is when it came out, I was well into my WWE kind of phase. Mm-hmm. I was really into it. And The Rock, as anyone knows, you know, there's never been a stink man like The Rock. He is amazing. Well, when he's in the ring and giving it all that. So that was his first big film role. So I was really excited to see him in it. What? Why are you pulling a face, Chris?
You just said the phrase, when he was in the ring and given it all that.
Yeah.
And I managed to not react.
I felt him looking at me and it
I feel like I've made a breakthrough here. I feel like I've turned a corner.
You want to talk about The Rock strudel?
I'm very proud.
The Rock likes to talk about his strudel.
Does he?
Yeah, well, he did.
Okay.
Maybe not so much anymore. Now he's Dwayne Johnson.
Can you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Exactly, literally. Mm. With the strudel. Anyway, so actually the presence of The Rock in that film was a big bonus for me. So maybe that skewed it as well. But yeah, right, he looked shit at the end.
He did. He looked absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. Emma, you probably weren't alive at the time, but when this movie came out, one of the very first things that, one of the very first big movies that came out when I joined Empire, and I just remember everyone being in the screen room and that thing comes out and you kind of go, well, I'm sure this movie will be great when it's finished. Mm-hmm. Well, it's out in 3 days' time. Ooh. Okay.
No, the first one was one of the big films at school that kind of, it was, you could go and see it if your mum would allow you, but I didn't go.
Yeah.
I think, I can't remember how old it was. But yeah,
exactly the same. When I saw The Mummy, I called up my mum and, "Mum, can I see this?" She went, "You're 23. Leave me alone. Haven't you moved out already? Stop being a drain on my resources. I hate you." Anyway, I saw The Mummy actually in London when I came over in 1999 for an REM concert with my friend Ross. We went to see it at the Empire Leicester Square. We went, let's go see The Mummy. So we went to see The Mummy and I said, "One ticket for The Mummy, please." And they gave the guy a £20 note and he gave me back £6 change. And I actually said, no, I gave you a 20. Because I didn't realise that that's what London prices were, even a long time ago. 17 years, Jesus.
You're such a little country mouse, aren't you?
Thank you for finishing that sentence. But yes, it's true. Emma, What's your favorite, least favorite?
I mean, I didn't know whether I don't do myself any favors.
Do we need to preface this joke by explaining that Emma is professionally wrong in all of her film opinions?
I mean, Emma loved Chappie.
Yeah.
Chappie on list.
Chappie was the one I was going to bring up because, I mean, 32%. And
I think 27 of that was from us, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure.
Maybe it was my review somewhere else. I love Chappie. So I gave myself some higher ones that I could kind of avoid the robot questions. The other one, which I got stick for from my friends on Twitter when we were talking about something else similar like this a while ago, and I mentioned Chappie, and they said The Amazing Spider-Man 2, because granted I've not watched it since it came out, but I loved that film and I may have given it 5 stars, and let's maybe not talk about that again. I stand by it at the moment. I've not watched it since, but I'm scared to watch it back in case I am professionally wrong and just give James more vitriol.
You are, nothing is not consistent, and I think that's important. Yeah.
There's some good stuff in Amazing Spider-Man 2, but I don't see that being critically appraised in 10 years' time. But for me, it's Paul Thomas Anderson's third best film.
Yeah. So. That's pretty spot on.
What do I know? We should probably mention how Rotten Tomatoes works. Incidentally, it's not just that everyone gives these films like 1 star or 0 stars, and so therefore they get bad reviews. It's an aggregation, isn't it, of bad reviews and good reviews. And if you get over 60% or 3 stars, if you're Empire, then you're 60% and you're fresh and that's good. And if you're below that, then you're rotten and that's bad. And so it adds up all the reviews and divides them into good or bad. It's that simple. So it means that there's a lot of films out there that have had 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. I wasn't going to come in and just go through terrible films or films that are, you know, that I quite liked that have got a terrible Rotten Tomatoes score. Although Equilibrium, James, you and I have a love for that film.
Equilibrium.
38% on Rotten Tomatoes. And honestly, that's probably right, but it's got some great stuff in it.
That is literally better than everything Paul Thomas Anderson's ever done.
Be careful, James. You're treading on my dreams. There's a list, because there's always a list of everything. Wikipedia has a list of all the 0% rated films on Rotten Tomatoes since, you know, time immemorial, or when it began 3 years ago. Or
what stands out?
What stands out is there's a Paul Newman exploding volcano disaster film called When Time Ran Out, which is pretty terrible, but not 0% terrible. Anyone have seen that?
No.
You never seen that?
No.
It's not good, but at the same
time, apparently not.
At the same time, it's not 0%. Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, that's got 0% on here as well. The Hills of Ice Part 2, 0%. 8 Million Ways to Die, the Jeff Bridges film, based on one of the Matt Scudder novels. That's not a 0% film. That's madness. Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol. This is just nonsense. Jaws of Revenge. The best of the Jaws movies. No. Police Academy 6, City Under Siege, also gets 0%. But Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach, that was obviously a spike, a high for the series. Neverending Story 2, the next chapter. Second Sight, let me see what else. Iron Eagle 3 gets 0%. I mean, that's just wrong. Death Wish 5, The Face of Death, gets 5. Police Academy Mission to Moscow gets 0% as well. The Dentist, a Corbin Burnson horror film, gets 0%.
Chris, yeah. What point are you proving here?
I'm listing films that are quite enjoyable. That's the point of the question.
Oh, right, okay.
That's the point of the question.
I was confused because now it's just a list of shit films, right?
No, they're not shit, Dan. They're Police Academy films. Wait a second.
Look, you've got to look at the pre-Mahoney.
All right.
The Mahoney era. Post-Mahoney is just bad.
Yeah, when Matt McCoy turned up is just rubbish.
Lassard's nephew or Lassard's whatever nephew. It was, yeah. Just I mean, nonsense. What was that all about?
Nonsense.
Yeah.
Diabolical. Liberty.
Hateful.
All right, and then just from this year, I will mention very, very quickly, films that do not deserve to be 0% for me on Rotten Tomatoes, The Ridiculous Six is on there. Joe Dirt 2, Beautiful Loser. Haven't seen it, but it's got David Spade in it, so it's automatically good. And then last but not least, this is from a few years ago, Pudsey the Dog, the movie.
It seems harsh.
It does seem harsh. But there you go. That's that question answered, I'm sure, to the satisfaction of the person who asked it. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, do send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Oh, and by the way, our agony uncle Billy Zane is back. So if you have any problems, genuine problems, don't have to be film related, that you want Billy Zane, who's uniquely qualified, of course, having graduated from the School of Life, to tackle your problems in complete confidence, I will say, in a future issue of Empire Magazine. Also use that email address, podcast@empireonline.com. Use the subject heading Billy Zane or I have an embarrassing problem.
I've got a friend who fancies his cousin.
You got a friend who fancies Billy Zane's cousin?
Yeah.
How is Billy Zane going to help this? What do you want me to, what are you doing? What are you doing? That's why we never have you in the podcast.
Anyway.
You derail things. You're an anarchist. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us via Facebook, we're on Facebook as well as Empire Magazine. Right. There we go. Should we have a guest? Let's have a guest. Let's have two guests, in fact. Our guest this week, our first guest this week, are the co-directors of the mind-bending stop-motion puppet drama, and I always get this wrong, Anomalisa.
Correct.
Pink. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well,
is
done.
It right?
It's like Mona
yes.
Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa.
No. It's like anomalies, right? Anomalies.
Anomalisa. It's like Lisa. Anomalisa. Whereas anomalizer, as we've established, is what you use to surf the internet for porn.
Okay, you said that before we went on there.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now.
It sounds a bit like anonymizer. It's a pun.
Anonymizer.
Yes.
Okay. And I must have missed 60 minutes. What?
How do I need to explain this to you, of all people, how to be a deviant on the internet?
Of all people. You make it sound like when I'm not doing the podcast, I'm just masturbating. I'm not.
I do make it sound like that.
I am. What is the thing you just said?
An anonymizer.
Okay.
Anonymizer. Anonymous. Yeah.
What is it?
Anonymizer. It's it hides your IP address. I have heard on the internet.
He said far too quickly.
And masks who you are from websites and presumably your employer, Chris. So that's useful.
We should have a chat after the show.
Okay.
So the directors of Anomalizer? Anomalisa. Sorry. One is Duke Johnson, who may not be known to mainstream audiences, but the other one, Charlie Kaufman, is. He is, of course, the writer of Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind, Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, and the director of Synecdoche, New York. And he's now back with this movie about stop-motion puppets. And we sent our big-brained John Nugent along to climb into the portal inside their heads and extract the information from within. And how we managed to get back to that intro after what we just did... I deserve a Pulitzer, I think. Enjoy the interview.
So, Charlie Kaufman, Duke Johnson, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you both?
Okay, good.
Excellent. So, we're here to talk about Anomalisa, obviously. First off, congratulations on your Oscar nomination.
Thank you.
Did you guys attend the ceremony?
We did, yeah.
How was that experience?
I mean, we had different experiences. You know, Charlie's been there before, but, you know, my experience was... I was trying not to. It was pretty clear that we weren't going to win because we had been nominated for many awards leading up to that. Sort of the Oscars is sort of the climax of award season, and Inside Out had been winning everything. So I went into it, you know, secretly wanting to win, but just looking at the experience as a culmination of what we had been through with the film, and sort of a recognition of. A certain accomplishment or something. I don't know. It was nice. I brought my family.
Charlie, how was it for you? I mean, you obviously won in 2005 for Eternal Sunshine.
I did.
And that is one of my all-time favorite speeches.
The speech.
The film as well.
Whatever, man. It's one of my all-time favorite. It pleased you in some way.
Genuinely, the film is one of my all-time favorite films. You. But your speech is just wonderful to behold because you look really unhappy to be there, really. And
I was unhappy for a few reasons.
Yeah.
But I won't get into that. Did I look unhappy? I've never looked at it. I can't look at things like that. All I remember is that I was counting down with the... Suddenly there's a screen flipping number in front of me and I was counting with it because it seemed ludicrous to be there. But, you know, I mean, it's a weird thing to be put into this competition with things that have nothing to do with you and then to sort of like hope for results that are going to please you when obviously they make no difference in any way. You know, and everybody's there doing it in their little monkey suits. And so I feel a little bit like, you know, we've all been suckered. You know, I think if you told people ahead of time who won, then those are the people who would show up and they wouldn't have this show that gets to sell advertising time. So it's all about suckering people who want trophies to, you know, to show up. And there I was. So
what is the actual ceremony like? I won't talk about Oscars for the entire interview, but there's that Johnny Carson quote of like, it's 2 hours of sparkling entertainment.
It's a lot of people
stretched
that,
out to 4 hours, you know.
It's a lot of people that look extremely uncomfortable, sort of physically, because they're wearing things that are physically uncomfortable. Like the women look like they're in like sort of medieval torture equipment. Like they're walking on, you know, beds of nails and their feet are painful. And the men are all homogenized and like wearing the same thing. And they're also uncomfortable because they either... are nervous or anxious or want to win and or bored or don't want to be there.
Or angry.
But everybody's pretending that none of that is true.
Right.
Except me.
Except for Charlie. Charlie's the only
It was
honest.
Good this time because we were in animation and so we were relegated to the back of the room. So okay. There are no cameras on us. So you don't have to do standing ovations and pretend and that you're happy about things and because no one will ever see. So that's good.
Your fellow nominees in this category are mostly sort of family-friendly fare. Is it?
Completely. I think it's not mostly. I think
not
it's
mostly.
Completely.
Almost entirely,
it's
yeah.
For children.
Yeah. And your film is very much not family-friendly, I would say.
Very much.
Do you think it's a misconception that animation has to be family-friendly?
Yes.
Yes, we do. And we were hoping to prove that with this film, but we haven't been able to. It seems like it does need to be family friendly. So
yeah,
well, at least to be financially viable.
Yeah.
So, do you think the story of this film is very specific to animation? Do you think it could only be told through this medium?
No, it would be a different movie if it were told in another form. But it was told in this form, and it's just as viable in this form as it would be in any form. I mean, it's sort of. People ask, well, why did it need to be animated? Like somehow, if you do animation, you have to have, people flying through the air and turning into different things. But animation is just a way of making films. And the thing that people don't think about is that most of their superhero movies and other live action movies are almost completely animated now. So but they don't think they're animated. They don't really understand that that's animation. And
it's like Deadpool flying through the air, shooting bad guys. Like, that is animated.
Yeah.
The Bear and the Revenant is animated.
Yeah, that's
right. True, yeah.
Yeah.
We were at the Animation Awards when that bear won an award.
Yeah, and of course
sequence won an award for best animation in a live-action film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the experience like for you making this film? Because animation is such a labor-intensive process. I mean, how many sort of seconds of footage did you get every day?
The goal was 2 seconds per animator per day,
okay.
Which was often mostly not met, but that was the goal.
Okay. So, how many animators did you have on the
film? 13 at the most at any given time. I mean, there were different animators. They came and went, but that was the number that was working when the most animators were there.
So it's a very long and sort of drawn-out process. I mean, I know, Duke, you have lots of experience in animation, but Charlie, you're familiar with more live action work.
Yeah, no, this was.
Did you find it a sort of tedious process at times? Did you get impatient at all?
No, not really. I mean, we worried a lot about money. I'm not there manipulating the puppets, so it's not tedious in the same way it might be for someone who's doing that. But it, certainly had to wait for stuff to come in and get a second here or a second there of stuff to look at, and it was always exciting to see those seconds, but they were seconds, at a time.
Yeah. You obviously only have 3 voice actors in this film. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to cast David Thewlis?
I did this play in 2005, and the same actors were in that play. And I just cast actors that I wanted to work with. I mean, I didn't cast them and like you be in the play. I called them, people I didn't know, and said, would you want to do this play? And David said yes. So that was the reason. It was just somebody who I thought was a really great actor who I thought, oh, I have a chance to direct somebody. I'll pick somebody I really want to work with.
Is there anything about his voice that was specifically drew you to him? Because it's a very thick Lancashire accent, which is very sort of gratifying as a British person to hear.
I think his accent and his voice are great. Mm. And I guess that's part of what makes him the actor that he is. But it was the performance in Naked, which obviously has a lot of his accent in it. But that was the movie that I saw where I thought, oh, man, this guy's amazing.
And what about Tom Noonan, who essentially plays every other human in the world?
Again, he's an actor I really wanted to work with. But he has a voice that was what I felt was correct for this, where it's sort of like, it's very distinctive. It's got a very sort of distinctive delivery and inflection. It's a little bit sinister. It's a little bit calming. There's a kind of a monotone to it. And I thought it would be recognizable from character to character. I mean, my main direction to Tom when we did the play and when we did the movie, we wanted the same thing, was that he not change his voice for any of the characters. He could change his attitude. He could be a kid and he could be a wife and he could be a waitress, but it's still Tom doing it. And so I thought it was kind of brilliant the way he was able to portray all these different people without changing his voice.
And then we have Jennifer Jason Leigh as Anomalisa, or Lisa. One of the standout scenes in this film is when she sings Girls Just Want to Have Fun, which is a fantastic and very funny and quite sort of charming moment. What was the reasoning behind that specific song? Were there any other songs that you wanted to go for?
The play was a different song. It was My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. Okay. And we couldn't get the rights to it, so we had to find something else. And, you know, we kind of brainstormed, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun was one of the possibilities. And when we heard Jennifer do a rendition of it, we thought, yeah, this is the song. So
that's, yeah.
So it was fortuitous because it's better than My Heart Will Go On for us. But it's an accident, really, that we got it.
Was it something that had to be some karaoke, a sort of karaoke-level song? Or
I think we were looking for something quiet, trying to remember, and we were looking for something that would make sense for the character of Lisa to like. Do you remember what the other kind of
criteria? Wanted something that was sort of, what's the word?
Mainstream.
Poppy. Mainstream, yeah, that everybody would know, but that if it could have an additional meaning purpose, feeling.
Of all the songs that we were looking at for the replacement of that other song, this was the one that I think had those things. It felt like it pertained to Lisa in a way that, you know, was wonderful and surprising.
Another sort of standout moment in this film is the sex scene, which for a film that is animated, it's one of the most sort of realistic sex scenes I think we've ever seen. I mean, what was the genesis for this scene? How did it all come about?
Well, it's in the play. But in the play, since it's a staged reading, it was just Jennifer and David moaning on stage, separated by about 20 feet. So it played funny. And, you know, when we're going to realize it visually, we were talking about what it should be. And we wanted it to be true and honest and not a joke. There was sort of this sort of idea that puppet sex was going to be funny. And we wanted to fight against that. So we spent a lot of time trying to sort of figure out who these characters were and how they would interact at this point in their relationship. And then it was very complicated to animate. It took about 6 months. The bodies don't do that, the things that they were doing naturally. So there were a lot of rigging, and there was the bed had to be animated, and the clothing was animated. So it was a very complicated thing to shoot.
Does this sort of thing take a lot of storyboarding? Do you have to, I know with animation studios like Pixar, they like to act out scenes before animating. I don't know if this is something you would
do. We did both. We storyboarded it, and we also we brought in a couple of adult actors, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, animation is kind of, there's an emotional element, there's a performance element, and a lot of that comes from the voice actors and the animators. But then there's also like this sort of like scientific element. There's a physics to how things move and having it look physically natural. And, you know, how a bed compresses as bodies move up towards the head of the bed, and how the clothes come off, and in what order these things occur, and how the sheets pull back. And that's something that's, you know, you don't really want to have actors do because, I don't know. It's uncomfortable to ask them to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we brought in some professionals and had them kind of run through the motions of it a couple times and use that combined with our direction, combined with the animators, combined with the voice performances, and kind of came up with a plan.
And the actress did hit her head against the headboard when she scooted up the bed. And so, which was funny and sweet. So we had Lisa do that.
Finally, then, what are you guys working on next? Do you have anything else in the pipeline? Are you going to collaborate again together?
We'd like to do something else together. I don't know if it's going to be feasible at this point.
Yeah, it depends, you know.
Depends on if the movie makes money.
Anomalisa didn't make enough money in America to make a studio.
They're not beating a path to our door.
Yeah. But we're both doing other stuff. I'm going to do a live-action film next.
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying. I'm trying to get stuff done. We'll see.
Okay, well, I really hope something happens. We really look forward to your next projects.
Thank you very much.
Guys, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, that was Duke Johnson and Charlie Kaufman. We'll be discussing Anomalisa?
Yes.
Lisa.
Anomalisa.
Lisa.
Anomalies. I'm just going to say anomalies and then put an on the end.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be discussing Anomalisa later on in the show. But for now, let's talk about movie news. So what has been happening this week, people?
Well, they released some character shots, some more character shots from The Preacher Show, which is exciting, right?
Very.
Yeah. So we've seen another shot of Dominic Cooper as Jesse Custer and Joe Gilgun as Cassidy, the Irish vampire, mm-hmm. and Ruth Negger as Tulip, who is the third main character in it. I was going to say the love interest, but it just sounds crap if you just describe a character as the love interest.
Yeah, it sounds really reductive.
Yeah, it's really reductive.
Early 90s.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
Man.
Sorry, world.
Yeah.
So, yes, obviously, as James sarcastically puts it, discussing new pictures on a podcast is a little bit pointless, but...
In theory, Dan, discussing anything film-related on a podcast is by its very nature reductive and
pointless. Shall we stop?
Let's just stop.
Yeah, let's just not bother.
Okay.
Podcast cancelled. Bye. He's literally leaving the room.
See you guys.
He has literally left the room.
He can't get back in there.
And he didn't bring his card with him, so he can't make it back in.
Back.
Yeah, he's back.
So, yeah, so Preacher's like one of the all-time greats of comic books in terms of the new wave of kind of adult-orientated vertigo comic books from early 90s. Is it? Or was it before that?
That's Datus.
Yeah. I mean, my God. Anyway, so I'm really interested to see what they do with this. And of course, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are behind the pilot, at least. So that's an interesting choice. But as we were talking about actually in the office earlier, I really love the early Preachers in terms of the comic book. But I think later on, it goes a bit off the rails, gets a bit too wrapped up in its own kind of slightly juvenile kind of, we really went there kind of humour.
Yeah, you said that earlier when you were saying it's quite childish and juvenile, and we said, didn't you like the villain Hairstar? And Chris said, the one who gradually turns into a penis, and then we rolled about laughing while you glared at us.
Yeah.
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 So that may have proved your point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it starts off with a really interesting idea, which is that this preacher who's lost his faith gets imbued with the holy power of the word of God. And very much like Kilgrave in Jessica Jones, in fact, identically to Kilgrave in Jessica Jones, except this guy's a hero, in inverted commas, he can basically control people's mind. He can order them to do things, and they have to do them. So when he tells someone to go F themselves, and by F I mean fuck, there you go. That's the level of humor in it.
Dan comes on the podcast and just immediately it becomes just debauched.
I'm really interested. But we don't know when we're getting it here in the UK yet, do we?
No, we don't. I heard it might be turning up sometime in the US. So, but yeah, there's no broadcast of the UK yet. It's funny because this has obviously come just a few days after Joseph Gordon-Levitt announced his removal from Sandman, which I think came as a bit of a blow to a number of people, citing creative differences with New Line.
That old chestnut.
Yeah,
I was creative, they were different.
Well, quite, yeah. Which is a bit of a shame.
It'd just be so nice to see Dominic Cooper doing something a bit darker, because obviously he's got Agent Carter, but he's very sort of having a lot of fun with that. But you've never really... Well, I haven't seen the films where he's gone darker, and I think a lot of people that don't believe that he's really got those chops. So it'd be really nice to see him get his teeth into something. And Joe Gilgan's incredible, so to see those two go up against each other will be... hopefully amazing.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, The Devil's Double was a film, underseen film, which is actually pretty good. And Dominic Cooper's fantastic in that, I thought, playing two roles. And he definitely gets to explore his dark side in that. Yeah. But I know what you're saying. I think he's interesting casting all round. But yeah, the one I'm most excited about is Joe Gilgan. And Cassidy's the best character of the main trio.
He's amazing.
I love Cassidy. Yeah, it's going to be interesting because... Rogan and Goldberg have already said that they're changing quite a lot for the series, for the pilot and for the series. But at the same time, they love the comic book. And so it's interesting because the comic book is only 66 issues, and obviously Garth Ennis had a destination in his head when he started off. So I'll be intrigued to see whether this has a shelf life, whether, you know, if it ever gets beyond season one, whether they'll have an end point, because most seasons don't, do they? The Walking Dead is going to go on forever unless everyone gets... bored or dies, which seems unlikely at the moment. But it's very rare, isn't it, for a show to... Babylon 5, when it started out, they said J. Michael Straczynski...
Yeah, Straczynski had a very clear arc, which then got horribly derailed when they kind of cancelled it and then uncancelled it and kind of fucked up his whole plan, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Obviously, Game of Thrones has an end point, or will do, if George R. R. Martin finishes the books.
Battlestar Galactica had a definite ending. Breaking Bad had a definite ending. The Wire had a definite ending. Sopranos had a definite ending.
Yeah. Yeah, but they didn't start out at that point. The Wire, David Simon, for example, went just from season to season, mm-hmm. just hoping that HBO would renew it. So it's very rare for something to have an endpoint in mind. And I'm not saying this one does. I'm not saying that they're going to go, we're only doing three seasons of Preacher, which, of course, is, you know, unusual. Mm. But The Leftovers is, for example, let's just announce that it's going to be finishing with three seasons. Yeah. But, you know, but the point is, you know, are they going to go in and go, there were only 66 issues of the comic book, so we're only going to do four seasons, you know, which I think would be refreshing. Because then what you have is the creators and the showrunners, they just string things out endlessly and mm-hmm. they retcon everything and it all turns to mush.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited about it, so yeah. Fingers crossed. What's happened as well, while we're recording this podcast, we're recording it unusually on a late Thursday afternoon. The Captain America Civil War second trailer has literally broken while we've been sitting in here, so mm-hmm. we can't really talk mm-hmm. about it. But I can see Twitter's reaction to it, and it's squee and wee and oh my God and oh, you know, all those
fluids.
Things and some emojis and fluids, you know, that fluid emoji yeah. that makes it look as if... This is a very carnal podcast.
It's been a very sexual
I apologize.
Time.
Yeah.
I apologize for what's happening. This is what happens when I'm in close proximity to James. He just he brings something out of me. So we won't be discussing the Civil War trailer unless, of course, you wanted to do a podcast first, which is actually have us watch the trailer.
I'm bringing it up now.
Oh, I've got it. I've got it here.
Oh, let's watch it. Let's watch it. Oh, let's watch it now.
Emma, gather around.
Gather around. Okay, everyone.
Well, that's a very good trailer.
Okay, so we've now watched the live. We just watched the Captain America Civil War trailer. Wow, I'm impressed. Mm-hmm. But then again, I always would be
Mr. Marvel over there.
Mr. Marvel,
I've got a question though, right?
Okay.
Okay. When you're in a group of people, and then there's another group of people, and you start running at each other, right?
Yes.
How do you think they sort of beforehand they checked with each other who they were running at? I mean, what happens if you start running at someone and you think, actually, I'm going to change my mind, I'm going to run at that person over there, and then you end up, two of you end up running at one person, then one of the other people on the other side ends up with no one to run at, and they'll feel left out.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, and no one can ever see Ant-Man coming, so...
They'll never see
who's running at him?
It's all very interesting.
Yeah. Seriously though, fantastic, yeah. I thought. That was like, stakes are raised.
Squeeze, Spider-Man.
Yeah. And in case you haven't seen the trailer, Spider-Man's in it at the end. Now, what do we think of that? I mean, yesterday Quint from Indical News, Eric Vespi, was talking about how he would quite like Spider-Man to be held back completely for the movie, and I kind of agreed with him.
But that's such a little money, not even a little, that's a massive money shot.
Spider-Man webbing Captain America's shield out of his hands.
A money spider shot.
This is veering towards sexual again. Can we,
This is, I thought it was really, really good. But as someone else pointed out, I don't know who, sorry, they want to get the Spider-Man out there and the merchandise and the promotions for the film. And so
I wasn't sure about the CG moving eyes.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, I thought that was
really like that. I wasn't sure about that.
The whole thing looked very CG to me. So I need to go back. We literally only saw it once, and it was on my phone.
On a phone.
Optimal quality. Just how the Russo brothers wanted it to be seen. Mm-hmm. So we need to go back and explore every frame. But yeah, really, really good. And this time focus more on Cap and Tony rather than Bucky.
Yeah.
So it was very much...
That dynamic between those two is incredibly compelling. Weirdly, this is probably the film I'm second most excited about this year.
Yeah.
After Rogue One. And I'm just, this trailer really, really did it for me.
This feels like The Avengers. I think that's why it feels so exciting. Because... Even though we know we've got more Avengers films coming, this is the big show off that everybody wants.
Yeah.
And finally seeing everyone together, everyone, the expanded lot.
This could just as easily be the Avengers Civil War. It doesn't need to be, do you know what I mean? There's so many people in it.
Yeah, but as the Russo brothers have said from day one, it is Captain America and they will focus on Captain America. So therefore it is his story. And we should, in the interest of fairness and balance, I should say, and I've meant to say on the podcast for several weeks now, Captain America : Civil War. Because if it's good enough for Dawn of Justice, it's good enough for Civil War. So yeah, I think it looks fantastic. I am still worried about how they're going to fit that many characters and that many storylines into one movie and make it coherent and introduce Spider-Man, and who's clearly, as we had suspected, aligned himself with Tony Stark and Iron Man in this, as he did to an extent in the Civil War comic book.
Indeed.
As well. So that's very interesting. Scarlet Witch beating up the Vision, which is interesting because obviously in the comics they have a long history together. But also it's interesting because the Vision is very powerful and it shows that she's very powerful as well. So, power. But let's not dwell too much on Marvel.
There's the news that the Venom movie is getting some traction.
Yeah, that's interesting as well. It is happening, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it is. We don't know a great deal about it. It's got a writer, one of the guys who worked on Edge of Tomorrow. I love Venom as a character and I hated him in Spider-Man 3, as indeed, I think, did Raimi. But,
yeah, he didn't want to use him, did he?
No. And I'd really like to see him in a film. But it's interesting, you know, are they going to take Venom the villain or Venom the kind of... Because he's reinvented himself as an anti-hero, hasn't he, really, at this point? So, but yeah, I've always liked Venom.
He's going to be R-rated, talking to the camera.
Yes.
Doing rude things.
Yes,
all sorts of stuff.
His symbiote.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see how that one goes. I mean, you know, they've announced a Venom movie before and not quite got there. But
I'm worried it might be box office poison.
Oh.
That's a good bit. Yeah. Yeah.
Can we talk about the fact, again, back to Seth Rogen, that him and Evan Goldberg are producing a Where's Wally film?
We.
When's that coming out?
I
tried to find the release date, and I just looked on the list. And,
you are dreadful.
No, honestly, it did my head in. I just stared at that list. I couldn't see it anywhere.
It might pop up in Preacher. I don't know.
Is it not Where's Waldo?
Yeah, in America. Mm. But I guess obviously...
Because over here it's Wally, and over there it's Waldo.
Yeah, sorry, American listeners.
Yeah. So when's Wally? That's what you want to know.
Yeah.
When's Wally?
When's Wally?
When's Waldo?
That's interesting. So did they just get a tall guy with a red and white striped shirt to... star in that one.
Maybe it's a mystery. Like, they've got to find him, like, genuinely.
Mm. Like Paper Towns.
Yeah. He's gone missing.
Of all the parallels to draw, it is much like Paper Towns.
I don't know, my mind, I'm like Emma, my mind always goes to Paper Towns.
Yeah.
In any situation.
I've seen it really recently, sorry, that's why.
Okay. This week, there was confirmation as well that the Han Solo movie will feature Chewbacca, the mighty Wookiee Chewbacca, as we suspected. Some Mummy news, we talked about the Mummy earlier on. And there's a Mummy remake happening as well. Tom Cruise is starring in the Mummy remake.
Really?
Did you not know this?
Wow. Honestly, I'm glad I come on this podcast because I find all kinds of things out when I'm here. That's amazing.
Do you know who Tom Cruise is? Do you want me to explain that to you as well?
No. Good. Big, famous, small. Yep.
Big, famous, small. Yeah. Little tiny fella runs around clinging onto planes.
And I say that respectfully as a fellow small man.
Yes. But you don't cling onto planes, do you, Dan?
No, that's true. Paper planes, maybe.
Not after the last time. So, yes, John Cruise. That's what Sean Connery calls him. John. Alex Kurtzman, one half of the writing producing team, Kurtzman and Ortsey, is going to direct this movie. He's going to make his directorial debut in this one. Tom Cruise is in it. Annabelle Wallace is in it. Sophia Batel is in it. And now Jake Johnson, we like him. He's in talks to play a military character role written expressly for him. So I imagine he's a wisecracking military character in this movie, so that's exciting.
Can't go wrong with a mummy.
I hope that's a line. You can't go wrong with a mummy.
Do you remember the Russell Mulcahy mummy movie?
Jason Scott Lee?
Do you know what? I can't remember, but I can remember that it's got Arthur from EastEnders in it with Christine Hewitt.
Bill Treacher?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, there's a scene where you see them together. So it's almost like Arthur didn't really die in EastEnders. He actually ran off with the woman he was having an affair with. Yeah. Anyway.
No way. Two big trailers as well to talk about, apart from the Captain America : Civil War trailer we just discussed in great detail. So there was another Ghostbusters trailer, an international trailer that came out this week. It had some new footage in it, some new jokes, some new stuff that I'm sure will incense misogynists everywhere. It's got added Hemsworth, indeed. So I spoke to Paul Feig this week, the director of the movie, for a trailer breakdown in our very, very patented style. So you can check that out on the website, which I believe, James, is empireonline.com, is that correct?
.com, yes, that's right.
Okay, that's cool. Hardcore Henry, going
yes,
very quickly.
Which is the first-person action movie, which has Tim Roth in it.
It's an action movie that's
you
first person.
You know the really shit scene from Doom where it goes first person shooter.
I'm going to quibble with you on that one. That's a very good scene in Doom.
In an otherwise excellent movie. Is that what you're saying?
Which I'm not looking it up on
definitely
Rotten Tomatoes.
Definitely Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah, so this whole film is shot presumably with a strap-on GoPro. Dan, steady. And frankly, really, really just utterly mental trailer. Him jumping over cars, kicking people, shooting people, blowing stuff up. It frankly makes you feel a bit ill. It's quite motion sickness.
Yeah, I'm worried about how that's going to play out for 90 minutes.
Yeah, but really, really fascinated to see it. Like, really fascinated to see it.
Yeah.
Possibly in 3D.
It's out on April 8th as well. I hear good things. Yeah. I hear good things. Hardcore Henry, tale of a Hoover that can't take it anymore and turns on its owners. That's the breaking news klaxon, and that is because we recorded this podcast inadvertently in two parts. We were meant to record it in one part, but we got kicked out of the pod booth on Thursday afternoon before we could finish it all. And overnight, lots of news broke for us to discuss a little bit more in detail. Some of it is very sad. In fact, let's start with that. Let's start with the sad news that the great Ken Adam, the brilliant production designer behind so many of the early classic Bonds, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, some of the great Michael Caine, Harry Palmer movies, Yup Chris File, movies like that, Barry Lyndon, passed away at the age of 95 yesterday. Good old innings, as they say. Dan, you like me, you're a massive Bond fan.
Yeah, yeah, I actually met Ken Adam once.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Actually, on the set of Die Another Day, which he production designed as well. So actually, he did go for a very long time as an active production designer on the Bond movies. But yeah, he was fascinating to talk to. And I ended up, of course, talking to him more about the old classic Bonds. I mean, he is responsible for the, you know, the giant hollowed out volcano, isn't he?
He is, yes.
In You Only Live Twice, which is the best Bond villain base, right? Agreed, everyone?
I would say so. Yeah.
Yeah?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Or is it The Spy Who Loved Me's underwater base, which he also designed? So he wins twice.
He only wins twice.
But yeah, and Strangelove as well. I mean, the war room. You can't fight in here, it's the war room. That was his design too. And of course, that was very Bond-esque in itself. But he was just an absolute genius at creating these larger-than-life spaces that felt brilliantly real at the same time.
I would love to have been able to go to his house.
Can you imagine?
Do you think he lived in a Bond lair under the sea or on the moon?
I'm gonna hazard a guess that he lived in a nice kind of normal house.
Yeah.
Two up, 47 down.
Yeah. That's disappointing.
But he did have the car from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in the driveway at all times.
Yep, another one that he production designed. I think that's the phrase that I'm going to use. Weirdly enough, Dan, I don't think he did actually. Not to call your memory into question, I'm sure you did meet Ken Adam, but he must have been just on Die Another Day because he didn't actually production design it unless he was just there for a day and just happened, or unless it was someone pretending to be Ken Adam.
Or he was raiding craft services.
But the point is, he was a genius and had an indelible mark on movies, hugely influential, and will be much missed. Ken Adam, who died this week. As indeed, of course, did the great George Martin. He also contributed a lot to the Bond movies, wrote the score for Live and Let Die, produced Shirley Bassey's Goldfinger single, and lots of other stuff besides, including working with a band that I know you love, James, because you were dedicated to being wrong about everything.
Yes, INXS.
Oh, dear Lord. And the Beatles, of course, the Fab Four. He was a legend, and he passed away this week at the age of 90. George Martin, RIP. All right, other news that broke overnight. There was some interesting stuff. Halle Berry is in talks to be one of the stars of Kingsman 2, which is interesting, playing the head of what we're told is the CIA. There's going to be potentially an American version of the Kingsman in this one. What do we make of this casting?
I mean, I was super excited when Julianne Moore was announced.
Yeah.
So, sounds like they're bringing all the women in, doesn't it?
Yep. All the ladies.
All of the ladies.
All the single ladies.
I mean, they're not, but yeah. No, I think this could be really interesting. I don't know if they'll play on her sort of previous Bond antics.
Mm-hmm.
Or she could have a lot of fun with that if it goes a bit meta and sort of wink, wink.
Maybe.
Nudge, nudge, as I'm sure it will.
Nudgy, nudgy, winky, winky.
Absolutely.
It's going to be very, very interesting. Some more casting yet to be announced for that movie, so keep an eye on that one. But at the moment, yeah, Taron Egerton, Julianne Moore and Halle Berry. Not bad at all. What else happened overnight? So the Dark Tower movie, which I'm very excited / intrigued by, is has cast this Jake Chambers. If you know Stephen King's The Dark Tower, you know the central character, Roland Deschain, who is in search of the Dark Tower, he's played by Idris Elba in the movie, has a group of people with him, a group of followers, a quartet, as he calls them. One of them is a young kid called Jake Chambers, and their relationship is very, very deep and multi-layered and weird. And he's going to be played by a young British actor called Tom Taylor, who was very briefly in The Last Kingdom. Did anyone see The Last Kingdom?
I did, yes.
You played young Uhtred.
Oh, yeah, okay.
In the very first episode. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting.
And, of course, Daisy Ridley is now connected to Tomb Raider.
Don't know, that's a segue.
That is a segue.
Yeah, not for James, that's just sort of his inner monologue.
I don't know what you're talking
coming
about.
Coming out.
It's interesting. It's interesting in many ways that they're just revisiting Tomb Raider, but it's kind of in keeping with the direction that the game is going, since the most recent Tomb Raider games have both been skewed younger, sort of origin stories, sort of young Lara, and she's pretty good casting for that. Very plummy accented. The thing that I most remember about Tomb Raider was doing the roundtables for the first film, and I remember sitting down with Angelina Jolie, and the international journalists on this roundtable were fixating on her bosoms. For everyone who doesn't know, obviously games are designed by Alison Boyce, so they are quite breast fixated. If anyone played the original game, she's quite, frankly, unrealistic.
There's a lot of pixels.
There's a lot of pixel density. And people kept bringing it up, and she was getting more and more irritated. And then she just flipped out at one point, sort of grabbed her breasts, reeled off her measurements, and said, can we leave this alone? We're done. I'm finished. That's it. We're not talking about this anymore. It was very, very awkward. I really did feel for her, actually, in that, because I think she'd really had
so many poorly chosen words in that sentence.
I apologize for that. But that's the whole thing. And I really, really profoundly hope that that kind of sort of, frankly, rampant sexism doesn't come up again.
Well, that's very interesting because... I'm sorry, Dan.
Well, don't you think, though, Daisy, really, isn't this a bit sort of typecasting? I mean, Ray is a scavenger who quite nimbly moves around large, kind of cavernous, subterranean spaces. Yeah. Mm. And now they're going to cast her as someone else who basically does exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's an odd thing, but I mean, for Daisy, you've got to think, what should she do next? I mean,
Daisy now, is it?
Yes, being Daisy, good friends. Okay. You've gone from essentially doing Mrs. Selfridge and not a lot on telly to doing huge film, to doing Star Wars. What do you do after that? I'm not sure this is necessarily what I would have chosen, just because obviously computer games don't tend to do very well. This is, as you say, it's a little bit too close. Will the film be very good? The other ones weren't. There's no evidence really to suggest that this will be, unless the script is amazing. I don't know, what would you have done? Would you do something completely different? Would you do like a period drama? Where do you go from Star Wars?
Well,
how do you break the curse?
She's going for another franchise as well, which you think...
I think she should be the new Bond.
Perhaps. Perhaps she should.
Jane Bond.
Jane Bond.
There you go.
There you go.
No.
I'm still furious about the female Ghostbusters, Dan. Do you want to...
Honestly, of course. Men's rights activist Chris Hewitt.
When's International Men's Day? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Oh, good grief. Yeah. Why is there a Mother's Day and not a Father's? Oh, hang on.
Wait a second. What's happening here? This is wrong. But this is really interesting because Daisy Ridley this week on Instagram, if anyone follows her in there, subsequently deleted this, but there was someone had posted a picture of her saying something like, Ray is setting unrealistic expectations for young girls to live up to.
Yeah. I saw that.
And Daisy Ridley posted quite fervent, because she's, you know, I like her on Instagram. Her personality really comes across, and sort of a very bolshy reply saying, you know, women are all ethnicities, all sizes, all shapes, just take me as I am.
The poster had said real women have curves, and she quite rightly pointed out, I am a real woman, so, you know. But then I think there was an outpouring of hate for the poster, and so Daisy then I posted again saying, please don't lynch this poor woman.
Think about it, she's very open, I think, to the feelings of her posters, and for the most part she gets a lot of love on Instagram, but it was interesting to see that caused a bit of a stir. It just feels like everyone's getting a bit upset about anything and everything at the moment.
Yep.
Welcome to the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so any other news to talk about? No? Okay, I'll do the breaking news klaxon. Beep, 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 beep. And we're breaking seamlessly back into the podcast.
That's it for the movie news. Our second guest this week is the best Taylor Joy since Dennis Taylor beat Steve Davis in 1817 in the World Snooker Championship Final in 1985. She is a true newcomer. She's the star of this week's The Witch, in which she plays a young girl who comes under suspicion of the worst kind, namely of being a witch. She is Anya Taylor-Joy. She's an Anglo-Argentinian actress with a faint American accent. And she was speaking to me when she came at the pod booth last week. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of The Witch, Anya Taylor-Joy. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So excited to be here.
Excellent, excellent. First things first, I have to start with your accent. Because it has intrigued me ever since we've been talking today.
Yeah, it's messed up, man. It's like... my first language is Spanish, and I only learned English when I was 8, even though we moved here when I was 6 because I was stubborn and I wanted to go home. But I mimic people in English, and it doesn't happen in Spanish, which is great, but in English, I'm all over the place. Like, be careful, I might start doing you very, very soon.
Interesting. My accent's a bit of a weird accent as well.
Where are you from?
It's a bit all over the shop. Northern Ireland.
Where?
a place called Banbridge near Belfast.
I spent 3 months in Belfast shooting Morgan, and I loved it. I absolutely love it.
Did you take on the accent?
Oh yeah, it was bad. It was so harsh. And my best friend still, like, you know, she's from there, and so whenever we talk, it's just instantly bang on.
Oh, fantastic! Because mine's a bit soft. It's been softened over the years. I spent a year in the States as well, which hasn't helped either.
And
I watch a lot of TV. Oh, thank you very much indeed. But yeah, it's just it's intriguing to see whether you can take on my dulcet tones over the next 20 minutes. So maybe I'll do a test at the end of the podcast.
It's so funny, actually. Like, people have already started. I don't read any of those comment things because they frighten me. But
Never read the comments.
They're scary, man. Like, I don't like them. There's some really aggressive people out there. But yeah, a lot of them are like, why is she pretending to be American? Like, that kind of thing's going to get her hated. And I'm like, whoa, okay. Interesting. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Amazing. Do you read replies to your tweets?
The witch ones are really funny because people just come, it seems like they come out of the movie and they just need to get their opinion out there into, like, the Twitterverse. And so I've enjoyed reading those quite a bit.
It is interesting. It's a movie that has lodged itself in my head ever since I saw it. It's one of those movies that gets under your skin.
Yeah.
Creeps and crawls around for a little bit. Which I believe is something akin to the experience you had when you were actually reading the script for the first time, that it was ill at fight. You read it at night.
Oh, yeah.
That's not...
Big mistake. Yeah. Big mistake. Huge. It was... Reading the script for the first time was just, it was unlike any experience I'd ever had before, because I went into it so kind of, like, innocently and naively. I was just sort of like, yep, okay, and now I have an audition tomorrow, so, like, read the script because that's my job. And when I turned the last page, I couldn't emote. I was so kind of, like, locked into myself, and I couldn't really understand what it was about it that had gotten me that way. Uh-huh. And then when I went to the audition the next day, it was the first time that I was just so unbelievably anxious to go to an audition. Like, I had never kind of, I was shaking all over. I was, like, verge of tears. And luckily, it worked out.
Wow. So for people who haven't seen it, you play Thomasine, who's, how would you describe this character?
Thomasine's a 15-year-old girl growing up in a puritanical family. Everything's so confusing for her because she's going through puberty and has left everything. You know, she's just struggling, man. She doesn't fit into her family, into her, you know, into the environment that she's in, any of it. And she's just really, really struggling to try and find herself and be herself.
Mm-hmm. And was that a character you could plug into?
Yeah. Oh, completely.
Right away. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because I'm from all of these different places, I've always had this thing where I belong. At the same time, I never belong fully. And so I've always been very kind of aware of feeling a bit like an outsider and not really fitting into my, you know, situations or whatever. And so, yeah, I had a lot of empathy for her.
Mm. And I guess that sort of struggle for identity and that struggle for self.
Totally.
Really, as well.
Yeah, but I think, you know, everyone kind of goes through that. And I'm 19 now and I'm definitely still growing up. I think you kind of grow up for the rest of your life. And I think everyone can... Oh, really?
I stopped.
You just decided, no, this is the day I am grown.
This is what you get, basically, for me. I haven't changed since I was 22. I'm still the same horrible person.
But no, I mean, hopefully it's something that a lot of people can kind of plug into for Thomasine. Yeah. You know, they can really, like, allow her to be their way into the world. Because it is, you know, when you come into it, it's in Jacobean English, though Rob recently told me it's actually not Jacobean, it's Caroline. And he's been telling me that it's been Jacobean for, like, the last year and a half. And I'm like, thank you, Robert Eggers. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Jacobean English. You know, everything's so historically accurate. So you really are entering into a world. And because Thomasine's, you know, growing up and learning about it, I think that it's quite an easy way in for the audience to go in through her eyes. And that's why Rob kind of based it on her, sort of thing.
Okay. So from her mm-hmm. point of view, as her parents are quite puritanical.
Yes.
Trying to adapt to the supernatural conditions around them, so to speak. What I thought was very interesting about the film is that Robert Eggers very early on declares that there is a supernatural presence in the woods as well, which I thought was very cool, very interesting. And he didn't keep a guessing game going.
Yeah, no, I love him so much. He's so incredible and talented and just a wonderful, wonderful man. But I think that it's really important for people to understand that, you know, whilst the witch nowadays is something that's quite, you know, Disneyfied and, you know, like a plastic decoration that you put on your house for Halloween, in, you know, the puritanical mind's eye. Like, the witch was real and was, like, a very, very real threat and something that was capable of doing, you know, all the horrible things that happen in our film. And so I think the decision to kind of show a supernatural presence so early on was really about allowing the audience to understand what it was that they were afraid of and to understand the stakes as to, like, you know, what's going on around this family. And that way, like, you can, you know, feel more for them because you're aware of, like, this kind of outside threat.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Disneyfied there. And I was reading one of your early auditions was for Maleficent.
Yes, it was my first one. It was I've never cried so hard in my entire life. I went home and I just sobbed for hours on my bed.
So it went well then?
Yeah, so well. It was fine. It was to play the young Angie, and I was very blonde at the time, like severely, you know, Nordic blonde, the way that I am in The Witch.
Yes.
And yeah, I couldn't believe that I'm the biggest Disney fan that has ever existed, like to a whole other level of like diehard. And yeah, it was just a bit too much for me.
Okay.
Just too emotional.
Well, where was the audition? Was it on the Disney lot? Or,
No.
Just the fact it was Disney that just overwhelmed you a little bit?
We're not even talking about my first experience when I went to the actual Disney lot in California. Like, I freaked out. I stayed for like 4 hours after my meeting, like walking around and looking at the illustrations and just like dying. This was just in one of the studios in London, but it was more about the fact that I walked in and my mum went with me and I saw all the posters on the walls. And I was like, oh my God, it's real. It's happening. I'm here. I've made it. And then it was like, yeah, you didn't get the job. And I was like, no. So yeah, it was a big introduction to acting.
Damn you, Disney.
Damn you, Disney.
I'll show you. So you're into The Witch. Film of The Witch. The complete antithesis, I'm guessing, of what could have been the experience on Maleficent with the big budget and the big sets and the catering and the warmth.
Yeah.
This is very, 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 very different to that. Where did you shoot the film? It was the middle of nowhere, essentially, wasn't it?
Middle of nowhere, but like the most beautiful middle of nowhere that you could imagine. It was about like, I think it's like 6 hours away from Toronto. There's this place called Mattawa. And we actually shot like an hour and a half away from Mattawa. But Mattawa is where we were living. And it's like a one street town. We knew everyone by the end of it. Like, they all really accepted us. We had such a great time. And it definitely like lended itself to creating this family atmosphere because, I mean, we were so honored to be here for the London Film Festival. And we had this moment, Ralph, Kate and I, where we just kind of looked at each other and we were like, this would be so different if we had shot this in England. But because we were so isolated and there was no, you know, cell service, there was no internet, there was nothing like that. And so we didn't have access to our support network. So we became each other's support network. And it's really interesting because it's just not really, it's not really changed since then. We've all really retained our bonds and we're very close.
I read another interview with you where you said that basically the entire cast is dead in your apartment.
Yeah.
LA.
That happened, and it was so much fun. It didn't feel weird at all. Like, it sounds weird. It sounds kind of creepy, but in reality, it was
creepy.
It's just
fine. You know,
it was four of us, and you know Ralph's wife as well. Like, just chilling out in this apartment. In
a one-bedroom apartment,
apparently. In this one-bedroom apartment, yes. Okay, wow. But they were sleeping on the couch.
Were they crammed into corners? Were they under the sofa?
I just put them in all of the cabinets and the drawers and, like, stowed them away for safekeeping. No.
Amazing. And did they give you a good rating, at least, on TripAdvisor or Airbnb afterwards? Did they at least do that?
I haven't even checked my Airbnb thing. It frightens me. I don't want to know what they're going to say. They're going to be like, what? Four people? What is this madness?
Yeah, I was promised a one-bedroom paradise and I had to sleep with five other people and a goat because I'm assuming that Black Phillip stays
with you
as well.
Because I said the entire cast, of course you did, Charlie came too.
So Black Phillip's real name is Charlie.
His name is Charlie.
The goat in the film.
Yes.
One of the greatest screen goats of all time.
Thank you.
He's goat. Goat.
He is, yes.
What was that experience
like? He is goat.
He is the goat. What was that experience like working with a goat?
So, we had a number of animals kind of around, and the majority of them very well trained, you know, like hit their marks, knew what they were doing. Really, really great. Charlie is a goat. Yeah. So you can't really teach goats to do that much. They kind of just like do their own thing. And Rob respects Charlie, but like the majority of the cast absolutely hates him, especially Ralph, because Charlie, they hated each other, just mutual hatred from the beginning, you know, like horns down, pawing at the earth, like,
oh, really?
Yeah, aggressive. But
wow.
Charlie and I got along great. Like we would always be, I have this really gorgeous picture of the two of us just like chilling out in the sun being like, life, this is great. We're making a movie.
Chilling with Bay.
Yeah. We just, chilling with Bay. I only just, that does mean before anyone else, right? I only just discovered this.
I have no idea if it means anything.
Oh, that, God.
You've taught me something today. Is that what it means?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. According to Google, Bay means
Who could possibly argue with Google?
No one, least of all me. But no, Charlie's great, absolutely great. And I actually really love goats now. I was thinking about getting like two little like pygmy goats to just follow me around everywhere and like make that a thing. Yeah.
So Ralph Ineson,
mm-hmm.
fantastic actor.
He is.
I know him best as Finchy from The Office.
Yes.
Presumably you've seen The Office. Presumably you
no, no, actually no.
Okay.
I've been exposed. I'm so sorry. We've talked about it, but no. I haven't watched it yet.
Okay.
I have a very long list of like stuff I must watch or else I'm just a terrible human being, but I will get there.
Okay.
There will come a time.
I mean, I'm not blaming you for not watching The Office. I think it came out about 10 or 12 years ago. You would have been 7, so you probably
I'd just moved here.
By at the time.
Yeah.
And you weren't speaking English.
And I was not speaking
English.
And
the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's all fine. But I was just wondering if you knew who Ralph was before you worked with him, whether you knew he was Finchy and this.
I knew him from Harry Potter.
Really?
Yeah. Because I'm a big Harry Potter fan. I'd learned to speak English reading books. And so, like, when the movies came out, I was really into them. And I really kind of like, I knew the faces of people, and I was just like, Mom, I'm reading with a death like each other. This is so exciting. And actually, our audition was phenomenal because it was just like this kind of serendipitous thing where we did the scene together. And this was my third audition. It was by the time it was the final one, you know, chemistry reads. And we did our big scene together, and we hadn't changed anything when we actually shot it. Like, we had done it the exact same way that we'd done it in the room that day, because it was just right and our energies kind of like met at the right place, and it just worked out. And he's the most incredible actor, and he was so committed to this movie. You know, he lost so much weight. Charlie put him in the hospital like 3 times. Like, it was, yeah, he was the leader of us, and he definitely like got us all together and, you know, kept the good spirits going, and he's just marvelous.
Yeah, he's amazing. And he obviously has this wonderfully deep voice, you know. Oh. It's just amazing.
Golden honey.
Yeah.
Like dripping down from like more golden honey. Like, he's just miraculous.
And obviously his character, the father of the family, is very much someone who, from whom the family takes their lead, takes their cue as well. And I wondered if you took your cue in terms of that phenomenal accent that you did in the movie.
Thank you.
Now meeting you here as well and finding out what your accent is really like in real life, it's even more impressive.
Oh, so thanks.
How did you go about this? Is it something that, like, as you said earlier on, came naturally to you? Or,
well, this is the thing, mimicking. It's really difficult to mimic Ralph's voice just because, and I really don't do it on purpose. It's like this like weird compulsion thing that just like makes me do it. It's like an atonement, like, no, not atonement. I'm mixing up Joe right here. Hannah. It's like a Hannah adapt or die kind of thing. That's definitely not atonement. whoops. I couldn't really do his as well. But Lucas, the little boy, was 6. He's just got this beautiful, broad Northern Yorkshire accent, and it's just gorgeous. And so we would talk like maybe 2 minutes before going into the scene. I'd be like, hey, like, Lucas, buddy, like, what's going on? And we'd talk for like 5 minutes, and then I'd just walk in and do it.
So you don't keep the accent up in between takes?
No, and actually Rob would be freaked out because we'd be walking around. He's like, why do you sound Canadian? Like, why? Do I need to be worried about this? Is this something that we need to talk about? And I was like, Rob, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. I promise. And he was like, okay.
Amazing. I've got to ask one couple of last things.
Mm-hmm.
Not to throw too much back in your face that you've said in previous interviews, but it was interesting that you mentioned Atonement and Hannah. Because I also read somewhere that you are a big fan of Saoirse Ronan.
Such a big fan. I'm actually quite worried that she's going to read all these things and be like, psycho. But I do know. I love her. And I love her because I think that she made such great choices. And she was so young as well. And, you know, it's a real commitment to the integrity of the work. And to like these very kind of flawed, specific characters that I feel like a lot of people would shy away from. And she just didn't. And she went for it and she absolutely killed it. And I just started watching all of her films. And by the end of it, I was just like sitting on my bed and like crying with sheer inadequacy of just like, what? How does this person exist? Like, she's so talented. And yeah, I just think she's absolutely incredible. I loved Brooklyn as well. That score so is good. Stunning.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She can act a bit.
You know, she can act a bit.
She can act a bit.
Just a bit.
She's fine. She's fine. I take it in you haven't met her, because I'm getting the feeling if you had met her, we'd have heard the screaming from somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You were screaming, not hers.
Of course my screaming. She wouldn't be screaming. She'd just be like, what the hell? What's going on?
Why is this person screaming at me?
No, I haven't met her, and I'm not starstruck. Like, I just don't do that. And the majority of the time, it's because I'm oblivious. I have really bad eyesight, and I also just don't know what people look like all the time. I forget faces a lot. And so most, like, whenever I'm in LA, I'm always like, I think I went to school with that guy. And they're like, no, Anya, he's famous. Like, he's an actor. And I was like, oh, okay, got
it's
it right.
Tom Cruise, Anya.
It was Aaron Taylor Johnson. He came into a restaurant, and I was like, I think I went to school with that guy. And they're like, no, no, babe. No, that's kick-ass. Like, no. I was like, right, okay. But Saoirse, I just think I'm just not going to talk. I think I'm just going to be like, yep, no, nothing, no. Mm-mm.
Okay. Interesting. And then the very last thing, Anya, before I let you go is, has my accent seeped into your brain yet?
I've been fighting it so hard. I've been fighting it so hard. But I guarantee you that the second that I leave this office, you're Belfast, and I can't escape it.
That's not bad.
It's not bad at all. Accents, man.
That's not bloody bad, so it isn't. Mm-mm. Right. That's it. Absolute delight to have Anya Taylor join the podcast. Thank you so much
for having me.
Thank you.
She's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And she's going to go far. Going to go far, little young girl. Mm. There you go. Let's talk about The Witch. Let's start off our reviews section with, indeed, Robert Eggers' The Witch, one of the most hyped scary films of recent years. Dan, I know for a fact you've seen this because I'm sitting next to you.
Yes, I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And it's interesting because it's not really a horror film. So it's one of those, it gets tagged as a horror film. But it's something quite different. It has a lot in common with fairy tales. It's Puritans in America in the, I want to say 17th century. It is the 17th century. And they're basically this one family. Ralph Ineson is the father of the family. Kate Dickey is the mother. And Anya Taylor-Joy is the oldest child. They're like so hardcore Puritan that they don't want to live with the Puritans, right? They're like, no. We're going out into God's great country.
Well, they've been banished.
By ourselves, yeah, because they're so sort of, up in the grills of the other Puritans over there not being Puritan enough.
So I love God, man. You don't love him as much as I do. That kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. So they go off on their own and build their home on the edge of these big scary woods right out in the middle of nowhere and think they can make a go of it, basically. And it's a really interesting psychological setup because this is an era where obviously, science hasn't yet taken hold in people's minds. So explanations for things happening basically fall on superstition. The setup makes it pretty explicit. And this isn't a spoiler because this is the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
The setup makes it explicit that an actual witch comes in and steals away the youngest child, which is a baby, and kills it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then the rest of the film is the family dealing with what's happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact, this is the genius of the film, I think, despite the fact that you see this at the beginning, it's shown as something that happens, you're still not sure whether it actually happened, even though it's shown objectively. And it's all about the power of superstition to these people. It's like, if you believe it, it's real. And that's where the horror comes from. Because suddenly, you should be scared of the dark. You should be scared of strange women that you think live in the woods. And you should be scared of the woods as well. And so that's why it works so well for me. And you reviewed it for the mag, didn't you, Chris?
Yeah, I did, Dan. I gave this 4 stars, very close to giving it 5. But I don't think this is everyone's cup of tea, this movie. There's going to be a lot of people who will go in expecting a conventional horror movie, and this isn't that at all. There's a 1982 movie that scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. It's also called The Witch, although in this country it's known as Superstition. And that is a more conventional haunted house, evil witch, family moves in, people get bumped off, mysterious omen-like circumstances. That's the movie you want to watch if you want things to leap out at you. This really isn't that. It's a very, very slow burn movie. It's got a lot in its mind and a lot to get off its chest. But I really, really liked it. I thought it's brilliantly acted. very dark, very somber. We were both surprised, weren't we, to find that the director, Robert Eggers, isn't British, because we thought there's something about this movie that's reminiscent of Ben Wheatley's work, reminiscent of Witchfinder General, that great movie.
Hmm.
From the 60s, starring Vincent Price.
Yeah.
It's got that same sort of frosty, stark atmosphere. Really, really great. And if you like your movie goats...
I do, actually.
You like your movie goats?
I love goats. My favourite, up until I saw The Witch,
mm-hmm.
before we get on to the Witch's one, mm-hmm. is Jurassic Park's.
Jurassic Park's goat.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
Yeah.
My favourite is the possessed goat in Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell.
Ah, yes.
There's a goat demon that turns up during a séance.
Okay.
It's very, very cool.
Now we've got someone, haven't we? We've got
a goat who,
you know, really goes further than any other goat performance, I felt. Really pushed the envelope.
You really feel it. Yeah, Black Phillip is the goat's name.
Yeah.
And as you just heard in the interview with Anya Taylor-Joy, his real name is Charlie. Oh. And he's apparently a lovely goat. So, Black Phillip.
And he's on the poster.
He's G-A...
One of the posters.
He's on one of the posters. G-O-A-T.
The greatest of all time.
Absolutely. Well done, Black Phillip. He'll be winning Best Goat at next year's Gems and Empire Awards. All right, then. 4 stars for The Witch. But, you know, if you think you share my sensibilities when it comes to horror, if you know by now after listening to these podcasts for 4 years what the sensibilities are, then, you know, go on. What the hell? Add an extra star. But I will say, unequivocally, 5 stars to Anomaly. Anomaly.
Hey.
Anomaly.
What is it? What's it called?
Charlie Kaufman's new movie, Anomalisa. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, wait, it's Anomalisa.
Oh, for God's sake. Which is out this week in all good mind-bending multiplexes. Who wants to take this one?
I think I will.
Okay, Emma Thrower.
Okay. So Anomalisa is the result of a Kickstarter campaign and honestly, hands down, is in the 1% of Kickstarters that are genuinely worthy of your time. It focuses on motivational speaker Michael Stone, who's voiced by David Thewlis, and he's bored
David
of his... David that's uncanny.
Terrible experiments.
Dr. Moreau and your terrible experiments. I love it.
And
the chicken monkey me.
He's bored of his mundane existence, which is a bit of a surprise when you're considering his job. So in
I've
a
got
nuts-
a mundane existence. I love having a mundane existence. Sorry,
shall
I'm trapping all over your review.
That,
yeah, go on.
In that accent.
Yeah,
I don't think I can do it. I don't want to upset David Thewlis.
That's too late.
But in a nutshell, Michael checks into a Cincinnati hotel for a conference that he's guest speaker at, and he has a couple of drinks. He has a run-in with an ex, he has a few more drinks, then he meets Lisa, who's voiced by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and then they have a few more drinks. So everyone here is a puppet, and they've all got these clip-on faces, as Chris was sort of saying earlier, and it adds a really sort of novel kinetic energy, even in the stillness of the film, as everything seems to sort of fuzz along, a bit like in a Muppety kind of way. And the reason Lisa is so special is her voice, and this is Anomalisa's special weapon. So aside from Michael and Lisa, everyone sounds exactly the same. So Thewlis may be the main part here, but the film is all about Tom Noonan. So he's amazing. He's incredible as David's ex-wife, as his son, his waiter, his cabbie, everything. Every other voice is Tom Noonan. So the film starts on a plane, so it allows you to get accustomed to that idea before throwing you in head first and making for a really, really funny ride. And there are some amazing recurring jokes throughout. And even though it's a really pessimistic film, it surprisingly is really, really, really funny. But this isn't an out-and-out comedy. It's not an easy watch because its more pessimistic notes definitely speak to everyone on some level. So it deals with loss, deals with pain, acceptance, love, fun, happiness, basically every emotion. But it mainly looks at the self. So self-worth, self-love, identity, and all those big questions. And it asks a lot of questions of its audience, and that's where it really succeeds. So written by Kaufman, it obviously shares some DNA with his other works, sort of, you know, Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine, dealing with identity and what it is to be human. So... for me, there were quite a few bits that didn't sit quite right in the moment, but the majority are explained a few moments later. There's a really odd dream sequence, which doesn't seem to sit right when it happens, but I think on a rewatch, it will make more sense because it does get an explanation.
And what about the puppet shagging? What about that? That's cut to the chase.
Team America, I mean, you know, put it on the map. This is the complete other end of the puppet sex spectrum. Puppet sex spectrum. There hasn't been many entries that
Is
that like a ZX spectrum?
So, just to establish, there is a puppet sex scene in Anomalisa. And so there you have the Team America World Police sex scene.
This is a complete opposite of that.
Okay.
It's
tasteful.
It is tasteful.
Tender.
Like, yeah. Fuzzy.
Awkward.
I mean... don't know how to describe it. At first, it's very much like, how's it all going to work, you know, anatomically?
Anatomically, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anatomically. But it does, and that you don't 100% forget what's happening, that they are puppets. But it is, nice isn't the right word.
Oh, that's nice.
Quite human.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is, again, where the film really succeeds.
Hmm. Mm.
So we get to hear David Hewlett's sex noises.
Yeah, that happens. That does happen.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
You're right, I shouldn't. Anyway, yes.
It's a really hard film to fault, and I do completely agree with what Ian Freer said in his review. It's a minor miracle of a movie, the most beautiful, haunting, empathetic, tender, funny 90 minutes of the year so far. Whether those 1,070 people, the Kickstarter's donated a lot or a little, thank you.
Oh, amazing. Five stars.
Five flipping stars.
Five English stars for Anomalisa. Anomalisa.
Lisa.
Yeah.
Shall we...
I'll get that right for the
sequel. Never mention that film ever again.
It's anatomically correct.
Right, so let's move on from two absolutely belting films, and I'm not setting this up in any way, shape or form for a fall, to the latest in the Divergent series. What's it called this week?
Detergent.
Allegiant.
No. Yes,
Allegiant.
This is Allegiant. The third film in the Divergent series. For those who don't remember, Divergent, based on the books by Veronica Roth, this is a series whereby it's a future dystopic Chicago where the whole of society is split into factions based on personality traits, much like one of those magazine quizzes we all should do in Look-In in the 80s. And you are... That's a blast from the past.
Emma's looking baffled. She's going...
So what's a Look-In?
What's a magazine?
What's the 80s?
I was born
what
in
were the
80s.
You're killing me here. Yes, so they're based into factions. They're set into factions based on their personality traits, whether that be dauntless, amity, abnegation, erudite. The most upsetting thing is, I think, the inconsistency in grammar there. Really, it's either an adjective or an abstract noun. Can we please make up our minds?
So where would you put yourself?
The pedantic.
There is indeed a pedantic faction. So that was the first one, and Shailene Woodley's character, Triss, is identified as divergent. She doesn't fit into any of these specific boxes. She is all of these things, so, you know, a normal person. And she falls, gets on the wrong side of Kate Winslet, and it all goes a bit pear-shaped from there. The second film, Insurgent.
I don't recall asking for a recap before.
Yes, I'm doing the whole saga at this point. We're going to do the whole thing. The second film, Insurgent, escalation, Kate Winslet goes, it's a whole thing. This one builds on it from there. This is very, I mentioned this in the review, it's very common, I think, in young adult stuff where they have a central premise for a single book and they write that book and it does very well, and then they feel the need to expand this world, and each consecutive novel expands the mythology and gets increasingly confused. The Hunger Games, I think, suffers from this to a much lesser extent, in the same way that, you know, it's repetition and they're trying to build a larger thing into something that was actually quite neat and nice and self-contained. But this one does get quite baffling. So this one sees Triss, Shailene Woodley, and the ever-attractive Theo James as four head over the walls of the city out into the wasteland, where they run into a very sort of smirky Jeff Daniels, who runs the Bureau of Genetic Modification or something similar. And there's lots of eugenics and other stuff going on, and it gets very, very thick very, very quickly as you desperately try to understand what's happening, and you try even harder to, you know, care. And back in the city, the Divergent system's all falling apart, everyone's killing each other, again, for reasons that are never really made clear. It's got an amazing supporting cast, this has. I mean, you've got Daniels, you've got Naomi Watts is in there, Octavia Spencer's in there as well, Kate Winslet is dead, but she was in there. Ashley Judd pops up for a flashback. It's all right, that happened in the last film. You know, there's some great people in there, but it is very, very far from a great film.
Miles Teller, Zoe Kravitz, Ansel Elgort.
Indeed. Miles Teller's the best thing in it, actually. I think he's the little scallywag who's betraying them every 5 minutes and they never seem to learn from it. Peter, so there's probably lots of
but not to be confused with Peter, played by Joss Hutcherson.
No, not that Peter. He's a different Peter. So a lot of love for him, a lot of Peter files out there.
Peter's princesses.
Oh, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Peter's Princess.
I just learnt this.
Oh, please be kidding.
No, 100%.
This is the
I've
thing.
Just watched one of our interviews with Miles, and they're called Peter's Princesses.
Peter's Princesses. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're a Peter's Princess, you should probably go and see the film.
Yeah.
For anyone else, do not. It really won't make much of a difference to your life. This film is split
That's
into
not the
two.
Quote.
Do or do not.
Do
it won't make
do
a difference.
Not a difference to your life it will make.
I have gone off on rants on this podcast before about the splitting of the final instalments of literary adaptations before, but this is one of the more egregious offenders. In fact, much like this podcast, it was split into two parts, presumably because they got interrupted and kicked out of wherever they were recording it and then had to come back and do the rest the next day.
That would be an amazing reason for us.
Yeah. So the fourth in this trilogy, Ascendant, will be out next year.
Yes.
And I don't know quite what they're going to do. So this covers... Allegiant.
Imagine how they feel.
Allegiant covers most of the last book in the series, though it deviates a little bit and it doesn't have the, I think, quite controversial ending, so I guess they're saving that for the final film.
Maybe it'll just be people reading out the acknowledgements.
Perhaps it will.
Is it called Ascendant because it's at the arse end of the series?
It's arse endant. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. Good, hey, good.
I thought about that for like 30 whole seconds.
Well done. So yes, if indeed you are... Oh, here's the thing also with Divergent. So I'm going to go back to the first film. One of the other things, apart from the grammar, that really irritates me is they go for a special test which tells them which faction they're part of, like genetically, and then they get to choose whichever one they want.
Yeah.
And then if it turns out that they're Divergent, they get killed. But it doesn't if you're genetically part of a faction, how do you get to choose a different one? It doesn't make any sense.
What does the sorting hat say?
This whole saga makes no fucking sense.
James is so Slytherin, right?
Oh, so Slytherin. Slytherin at Labooth, Slytherin at Labooth.
When he mentioned eugenics, I thought he was going to go on about, you know, how great they are.
Harry Potter.
Yes. So, yes. Right. Shit sorting hat. That's this series. Don't watch it. Two stars.
Wow.
Okay. Two stars. Really? Yeah, you could have fooled me. I thought that was a 4-star rave.
Yeah.
I really want to see what your 2-star rants are like. Let's end on a high with Mr. Dan Jolin, who's going to talk about Kung Fu Panda 3, the third in the Kung Fu Panda series.
Yeah, the clue's in the title. So this actually is kind of interesting. They seem to be saying like this was, you know, it's like kind of the Dark Knight Rises of Kung Fu Panda films, because they're sort of establishing that this is a definite end, that, you know, they've been building up to this, and they kind of hinted, as you've been going through, about Poe, Jack Black, his origin. So in the first one, it's never commented upon that he's the only panda there and his dad's a duck. And then the second one, kind of, you get a little glimpse into what happened and the reason that he got dumped on his dad's doorstep, and you saw little flashbacks to him when he was a baby and his mother. So of course that left the question who his father was and where are all the pandas in this Far Eastern talking animal world known as the Valley in the film. And so what this film does is it basically gives you the full reveal of Poe's backstory, his origin, if you will. And we get to meet his dad, who turns up on the scene and is voiced brilliantly by Bryan Cranston, because I think everything Bryan Cranston does is brilliant. So I should go without saying. But yes, it's a fantastic vocal performance. And him and Jack Black, it's funny. It's kind of like you can hear chemistry. And I don't even know if they were in the same room at the same time when they recorded it. But they make a really great double act on screen. But of course, it wouldn't be a Kung Fu Panda film without a big threat. And for the first time, it goes properly supernatural with its threat. Ooh. So the first film was a former student of Poe's teacher, who is the villain. The second film set up a different kind of villain who was using technology, gunpowder, what have you, and that was the threat. This is someone from the spirit realm. So a villain from the past who is returned from the dead and is a big bull voiced by J.K. Simmons called Kai. And there's a good running gag throughout where no one's actually heard of him and he's really annoyed and he has to keep explaining who he is because he's from 500 years ago in the past. So he comes back and he's doing this thing where he's basically capturing the chi, which is kind of the little, I don't know, MacGuffin's not quite the right word, but it's a little theme here, chi. And he's captured chi of all these other kung fu masters and made them his kind of jade zombie slaves. So yeah, it has this really cool visual look to it, actually, because of this. You've got all these kind of clickety-clackety looking kind of jade zombie animals. It's bloody weird. But it's a fantastic looking film. I mean, DreamWorks know what they're doing with this kind of stuff, but it's gorgeous and painterly, and it has those kind of segments within it that are done like beautifully hand-drawn or inked, and kind of make you wish the whole film looked like that, to be honest. Because I'm going to have to say, I'm now officially quite bored with CG cartoons. I just think they tend to have a texture and a feeling that is just got really, really uniform. It's got really blanded out. So anything that they can do that makes you realize that you know, you can actually use, you know, computer techniques with animation to create other effects is something I'm all for. So
we were talking about the Lego Movie yesterday.
Indeed we were, which of course used a low frame rate.
That's right. Yeah, it reduced the frame rate to make it look like stop motion.
Exactly. Mm. So this has really nice touches on those lines. And, you know, this use of 3D is great, although, again, I'm just one of these people that, like, after the first 2 minutes of looking at something in 3D, your mind adjusts and it stops becoming remarkable. Mm. I think the real joy of this film is just in the gags. Jack Black, I always think, is really good in this role. Yeah, as I say, Bryan Cranston, I think, is the most valuable panda in this movie. So, yeah, our reviewer gave it 4 stars. I would go more 3.5 personally, mm-hmm. but, you know, mm-hmm. that's just being picky.
Just being picky.
Is the snake in it?
Yes.
The Kung Fu snake really bothers me because he doesn't have any arms or legs. She. Yeah. The non-gender specific snake bothers me. Snake, Kung Fu, no. It's weird and wrong and no.
Okay. Go back, watch the film. She's got some good moves. She's got some well good moves, I think is the technical term. But yeah, I mean, actually, do you know what? That's the crazy thing about these films. You look at this voice cast, okay? So Jack Black, mm-hmm. Angelina Jolie, Jackie Chan, mm-hmm. Seth Rogen, mm-hmm. Lucy Liu, Dustin Hoffman, yeah. Bryan Cranston, J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
What sort of snake is she?
A viper.
All right, see, yeah, I'm with James in this. This bothers me. Because why would you bother kung fuing people when you can just bite them and take them out with your deadly venom?
Because she is a hero. And she's not going to poison people.
Yeah, snakes don't think like that, Dan. I'm sorry. All snakes react to our threats, heat, and, you know,
okay.
an instinct. So, right.
Who in this podcast owns a snake? Me. Okay, so don't lecture me on snakes.
You own a snake.
I own a snake. A corn snake. He's called Basil.
See, a corn snake? That's fine.
Yeah.
You know.
He's lovely.
Yeah, it's not a black mamba. I've been watching a lot of snake programs recently.
Okay.
Anyway, you mentioned J.K. Simmons there, and it reminds me there were 2 big bits of news we completely forgot to talk about. Let's talk about them briefly here. One is that J.K. Simmons is Commissioner Gordon in Justice League. He's just been cast. He's one of the increasing Venn diagram of people who've been in Marvel properties and DC mm-hmm. properties now includes J.K. Simmons at its core. What do we think about that?
Great casting.
Him
in anything.
J. Jonah Gordon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
J. Jonah Gordon. Exactly. Do you have Marvel miss a trick by not recasting him as JJJ in their upcoming Spider-Man reboot? Or do you think they might go in a different direction with that? Or do they not want to confuse the issue by having him in there?
Allison Janney.
Yes. Allison Janney. As J. Jonah Jameson.
Jane Jonah Jameson.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That is good
just
casting.
Putting it out there.
Allison Janney as anyone in anything.
I can even see the hair working. And speaking of Spider-Man, Zendaya, who's an American actress and a singer, she's been cast in an unannounced as yet unconfirmed role also in the Spider-Man reboot, which is very, very interesting indeed. What do we make of that? Is she going to be Mary Jane Watson? Is she going to be Gwen Stacy? If so, interesting, progressive piece of casting, obviously.
Hopefully neither. Neither?
Neither. A new character?
Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be nice.
Interesting.
But obviously, I have no idea.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we brought that up.
Yeah.
Right, so that's it. That's it for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by, I have literally no idea who we'll be joined by next week. We're working on a couple of interviews, which, if they come off, will be great. And if not, then it'll be just Dan talking about a snake again.
I can bring Basil in.
Don't. I hate snakes. I hate them. I don't hate them.
Oh.
I do.
Grow a little backbone.
Until then, it is goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from James.
The second part of my goodbye is being split up and will be released at some point next year.
So it's just good then?
Just good. Good.
I beg to differ. It's goodbye from Emma.
Yeah, normal, conventional goodbye.
Normal, conventional goodbye. Good, good, good. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to be voiced by Tom Noonan. I'll see you next week, everybody. Bye. That was my Tom Noonan impression. I have no idea what he sounds like.
he's Francis Dolarhyde, isn't he?
He is Francis Dolarhyde,
Manhunter.
Yeah.
So say, I am the Dragon Rampant.
I am the Dragon Rampant.
There you go. That's Tom Noonan.
There you go. Live Tom Noonan voice in here on the Empire Podcast. See you next week. Bye-bye.